You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
This was a great conversation, and it should be. Michael Chad Heppner is the CEO and founder of GK Training, a firm dedicated to giving individuals, companies, and organizations the communication skills necessary to reach their highest goals in work and life. Mike has worked with tons of cool people. Andrew Yang, he helped out when he was running for president. He's got a theater background, so we go into that. He taught at Columbia University Business School in the PhD and MBA programs. And he's got a new book. It's called Don't Say How to Communicate Effectively to Live a Better Life. Enjoy the pod.
It's just another bed and left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Michael Chad Heppner, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I want to start our conversation with something you write at the end of your new book, Don't Say Up. You write, quote, "In my line of work, you very frequently encounter incredible communicators who are not incredible people. You know who tend to be great at presenting, but not so great for the planet, narcissists and egomaniacs," end quote. So I like that you stress the moral and ethical imperative of good communication.
Yeah, I do think it is a moral and ethical imperative.
Because most people, I don't think that doesn't show up in a lot of communication books, just so you know.
But what shows up in a lot of communication books? I'm dying to know. Because I wrote one, but I'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, you do know. A lot of bad advice, a lot of pablum, a lot of the things that you warn against in your book.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think it is a moral and an ethical obligation. I really do. Mm-hmm. Think about how communication works. The evaluation is not, do I look good? Do I sound good as I speak? It only has one barometer of if you are a successful communicator, which is, did the person you were talking to receive your ideas or not? That's it. So if we take as an idea, and I'm using it if, I don't know or not, but if we take as an idea that we're trying to, as a society and as a civilization and as a species, construct something worth constructing, bending the arc of the moral universe, you know, et cetera, if we're trying to grow towards something, it would stand to reason that one of our challenges as communicators is to communicate worthy and ethical and moral things to each other and therefore actually behave in those ways too.
Did you? I'm the first one going on a tangent, but I'm going to do it.
Go away.
There was a book called Messy, Tim Harford book a while back, where he talked about Martin Luther King's "I Have a Dream" speech. Uh-huh. That midway through, he decided to improvise. Do you know about that story?
I know of the story. I don't know exactly in the book you're referencing. No, but I do know the story. Yeah.
Right, and it's unbelievable because he had this sort of prepared speech, which was not necessarily the one that was the one that got delivered, when he realized that he had to pivot. And Mahalia Jackson behind him had heard him speak in churches, and she said, "Tell him about your dream, Martin." And that's when the "I Have a Dream" stuff came out, and he just pivoted into that. And this is, talk about communication. This is something that rings through the centuries, and it wasn't just planned words. It was also taking into account all those people he was talking to and what he was sensing in the crowd that allowed him, with help from a friend, to make that pivot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it may be the greatest speech ever. both in content and delivery, by the
way.
And the thing that is, it's core to what you're talking about, and is totally relevant to this audience. So if you're listening, the thing about that is, yes, it was this like lightning in a bottle moment of absolute transcendence. I'm not a historian, by the way. Okay. So slight tangent, but from what I know anyway, he had shared some of those ideas previously in terms of the metaphor and the kind of imagery he's using, but he hadn't put it together exactly like that ever before. So the point is this, is that a lot of you listening might have these very set ideas about what presenting is or is not, and even what generating interesting material is or is not. So the lesson on that speech, countless lessons, but one of the lessons that as a speaker you can take is that part of your job is to practice the skill of turning air into sound and sound into words and being an orator. Even though you're not MLK, I mean, no one is, but even though you're not even in that role, right?
Yeah.
It's still your job to continue to see what it is like to put ideas into sound in the world to try to make an impact. And by the way, just because you've said the same story before does not mean you're a fraud if you use it again. So figure out what your biggest ideas are in your life. Practice talking about them, and they'll probably come in handy at some point. Maybe not on the Mall of Washington, but somewhere.
So your book gives away a lot of sort of secrets and ideas and things you use. And I'll give you one, which is often I will try to start a conversation with a guest with something from the last part of the book, because it shows them I actually read all the way to the end, which I did. What I also realized in doing that and then jumping to the beginning of the book is you bookend your book with your ethical stuff, because the title, you basically say, I'm being an untrustworthy narrator. So when you say, don't say, you actually don't mean that.
I don't mean it at all. It's a trick. If you've bought the book, if you're listening to the book, if you are enjoying the book, then yes, I chose that title to get people to pick it up. And the reason is it's very likely they have that pain point of trying to remove ums and ahs and filler. And many people even have that advice ringing in their head. Don't say don't say don't say Or they have a bunch of other don'ts, right? Like, don't make distracting hand gestures. Don't be salesy. Don't. So the don't is very much an invitation, hopefully, to get people to pick it up. But the second part of the title hints at what you just asked me, because the subtitle is How to Communicate Effectively to Live a Better Life. So if it's not way too audacious and bold to hope for this, the reason I started the book off with these bigger sort of ethical framings at the very beginning and the very end is legitimately, I really do hope that people who read this and listen to this don't just become better presenters and better public speakers, but that they actually have a better life. Because we say words out loud 5 to 10,000 times a day, depending on the day. So it stands to reason if you could do that just a little bit better every single day, it could genuinely make your life better.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a yes and idea, because what it really is talking about is, the reason we use yes and is for many reasons. One is we want to work from a place of abundance. What we recognize is that you need lots of ideas to have good ideas. And I mean lots, thousands of ideas to get to good ideas. And that's not an audacious thing. That is what it is. And I think the latest neuroscience says that we roughly have 60,000 thoughts that come into our head during a day. 30,000 of those might be novel. So where are we working with these big numbers? And the thing that you're yes and is you can practice this in every conversation that you have, from waking up in the morning, talking to your spouse, talking to your kids, talking to someone at the Starbucks, to in the office. Every one of those things is an opportunity for a kind of connection that is so much richer than the ritualized way that we, and many of us, walk through our lives.
Yeah. And not just what you're saying, but it's endangered. Communication is an endangered species. What you're saying is, yes, genuinely, it will become a virtuous cycle, and it will become actually a energy generating experience of talking to people, because so much of the time right now, we're staring into devices or screens of some kind or other. I'll even go further, actually, which is, not only are all those situations opportunities to practice, to get better at speaking, which they are. So I'm in no way minimizing what you just said. Yes, and to use the exact parlance, yes, and you might even feel better. I mean, if you open your mouth more to spit your words out better and enunciate more dynamically, if you actually allow breath to come into your body to support your voice so you have these five P's of vocal variety, which we can talk about if you want to, if you open your mouth and if you allow more oxygen into your body when you talk, you might even feel better throughout the course of your day.
So we're recording this on November 26th. On November 25th, yesterday, Microsoft was not being kind to me. I don't know if you're on these platforms, but it was down and it was glitchy. So I always check in advance for how to pronounce my guest's name, and I could not get the video to play. So I had a lunch right before this, and I'd forgotten to do it before, so I ran back, popped up. First video I see is you being interviewed by Andrew Yang, which is not an accident. That's an origin story inside the book. So how'd you get connected to that guy?
Yeah, sure. We were connected through a mutual friend in the tech community, and I went to one of his events, and I talked to him and his campaign manager, Zach Grauman. If you're out there listening, Zach, hey, what's up? And I went to this event, and we talked a little bit. We had a nice conversation, and essentially they said, come in sometime, and let's see what you do and see what you know. So we had about a half-day session at some point. I walked them through how I work and the methodologies and things like that, and I think it was quite useful. For Andrew, he's a super smart person, by the way. And for those who don't know Andrew, he is a wonderful human being. And he's someone who's very much speaking the bookends of the book, trying to accomplish good things in the world. So thank you, Andrew, for being awesome and a hardworking person trying to help the world. He also has an incredibly efficient brain. He spent 4 hours with me. And I think in his head, there was a box checked like, okay, got it. Good to know. I have conquered communication. Fast forward, he had his first debate in the Democratic field in Miami, and it was a complete crash and burn. Like, not a little, like, total crash and burn. Fewest total seconds of speaking of any candidate. Fastest rate of speech, which was 7.2 words per second at one point, which, by the way, that's pretty darn fast, in case you want to keep a stopwatch. And the debate went very poorly. So I emailed the campaign the next day. I was like, hey, how's it going? They said, can you be in Portland tomorrow? So I flew to Portland and we worked together very intensively for about a week and a half, almost training like, you know, a prize fighter or something like that. And he crushed the second Democratic debate. Huge comeback story. Absolutely slayed it. Now, yes, that does put me in a positive light. And I like to think that I did really good work with Andrew. But some of the credit goes to me. Most of it goes to him. It really does. Because I often will tell people that my coaching doesn't vary a whole bunch day to day. I'm a little better some days. I'm a little worse other days. But what varies dramatically is if people are actually willing to learn, if they're open to practicing, trying, to risking, to your point even, to yes-anding things as opposed to like, no, but I already know that, or no, but I've already done this thing. If they're open to yes-and in their life and in having a growth mindset, that's what determines if they get better or not.
Because it's not really about the knowledge. You know, it's not about this know-how, because you can have all the knowledge, and we know this. I literally, the lunch I just had, my friend Mark has just spent a week with, he was in Germany with these incredible scientists who work for a car company, and he was there to do storytelling work because they didn't know how to talk to each other. And so this is a thing that affects really, really smart people. This has nothing to do with IQ. It's that they don't know how to do it. Yeah, and they don't practice. And so over and over in this book, you are giving very specific exercises and tips and which come from a background that I suspected and was quickly saw was true, that you worked in theater.
Yeah. There's two tracks to that story, by the way, which yes, from theater. So yes, and to theater. Yes, and to the principle of yes, and yes, and also to theater. Folks, if you're listening, you've ever wanted to take a singing class or an acting class or a theater class, go do it. It's amazing. It's an incredible use of some of the short time you have on this planet. So are there parts of this book that are really, that blossom out of a foundation of artistic education? For sure. I'll give you one very concrete example. The idea of being other focused, that sounds so simple. Like, okay, other focused, right. I should think about something besides myself. Yes. how actors overcome self-consciousness on stage much of the time is not by like inner voice coaching about stop being self-conscious or let your mind go or stop being so. No, all they do is they anchor to whatever they're trying to achieve with the other person on stage. They get everything off their scene partner. So that example of being other focused, focus on the other person, that comes exactly from the world of theater. Mm-hmm. What is different in this methodology that has really been defined by the last 15 years of my life, as opposed to the 10 years I spent as a professional actor, is that I have built a whole framework and a process of using kinesthetic learning to help people unlock what they know how to do when they are at their most other focused, but forget to do when they're feeling very self-conscious. Hmm. And the reason it's important is because even people who don't have an artistic background, who don't really know how vocal production works, or haven't really ever studied yes and or these kind of ideas, they still can stack Lego blocks. They still can walk with their fingers. They still can use post-it notes or throw balls. And so I use these very concrete kinesthetic tools to help them unlock what better looks like for them.
The idea of embodied communication, as you sort of say, lives in theater, but I too have been really moved and impressed by the science around this. So Annie Murphy-Paul wrote a book called The Extended Mind. And this was just so, and basically the thesis of the book is that we have bad metaphors for the brain, especially when we think of it as a computer, because it's not. It yeah. operates differently if we're outside, if we're inside, if we're with people or not. Whole chapter on the power of gesture.
Yeah.
Hold. And so you alluded to this early, the what you do with your hands thing.
Yeah.
And I think for myself, and I do tons of public speaking, and you can even see the conversation now, I'm gesturing because like I keep my hands up here, man. My hands yeah. need to be like up here because I've got stuff I'm saying and they're part of that process. Will I put them in my pockets at a certain point? Absolutely, because I'm shifting and I know we want variety in terms of our presentation. But people, you can just tell, and this is a, you know this from auditioning. You know, at Second City, back in the day, it's a little bit more strict now, but back in the day, we kind of would see anyone off the street for generals. Mm-hmm. And I could look at the person walking on stage and mark them off, like they're not going to succeed based on what they were doing or not doing with their hands.
Yeah, I completely buy that. And this is so the first four chapters of the book, it's all about disabusing people of a bunch of the garbage guidance and feedback they've received in their life before. And I think hand gestures is absolutely ground zero for bad advice. And I even challenge people in the chapter on gestures to think of all the don'ts that you've heard about gestures. There's like, don't put your hands in your pocket, as you just talked about. There's don't point at your audience. Don't make gestures that are too dramatic. Don't twiddle your thumbs. I mean, it's just like a litany of don'ts. Don't. Well, all that does is activate thought suppression and self-focus. So all you're thinking about is you and your gestures. But to your point, you have discovered that actually when I'm talking at my freest, I actually use my hands, and not because I'm being dramatic, but because gestures come from this very core need of I need something beyond just my words and the sound of my voice to try to convey something. And so our gestures get involved. This closing this perception to reality gap for people between how much they think they use their gestures and how much they actually do when they're enjoying life and focusing on reaching the other person, it is shocking how big that gap often is. Yeah. It's also shocking how much people cling to the idea, like, I can't really talk with my hands because in life I use my hands too much. And I always say, why are you listening to that voice? I promise you, I have more expertise and a much better track record than whatever voice you're listening to. Why are you still listening to the same voice that says, like, don't talk with your hands too much?
Because the other thing is, I talk about this as it relates to improvisation for my audiences, which is, you know, so many of us walk around in judgment of ourselves or judgment of others. And of those two states, what are we more often in? Judgment of self.
Yeah.
People are very concentrated on themselves. Oh. And no one is going into this keynote thinking, I really hope they fail. What I want is total failure of that person up there. No, they actually want you to do well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. No one's sitting there saying, like, I really hope I'm bored for 15 minutes.
Yes.
I hope that I get a great boost of Schadenfreude for my day. I just want to watch agony, please.
Yeah, no one does that.
No.
You talk about eye contact in the book,
yep.
and I do a thing. When I talk to a big crowd, I always find someone to make eye contact with, in part because I went to see REM before they stopped touring at the Auditorium Theater, and Michael Stipe, the lead singer, did this thing where he, 3-4 times throughout the concert, found someone to make eye contact with the audience and wouldn't break that until he understood that they knew he was making eye contact, that they were the one. And it was so intimate in this 4,000 seat hall.
Yeah. I referenced something similar in the book on iChat. Brilliant story. Brilliant. Because already, viewers, you can imagine, wow, that must have felt amazing for that person. But it felt amazing for everybody else too, for two reasons. One, when Michael Stipe is more focused on reaching that person, automatically, he's going to be slightly better as a communicator because he's in a spontaneous moment of reaction with someone. He's trying to achieve something. And, you know, in actor parlance, he's playing an objective, essentially, to the person in the audience. And so what that means is his entire communication instrument, his gestures, his enunciation, his vocal variety, his posture even, everything will be almost quicksilver responsive to reaching that person. So he will have a slightly higher degree of spontaneity and being absolutely present in the moment on stage, which is electric to watch.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first part. But here's the second part you might not be thinking of. Mm. You and everyone else in the audience is thinking, like, what if he looks at me next? What if he looks at me? Am I ready? Am I ready? If he chooses, he's looking at that person over there. Is it? So every single person in the audience is filled with this anticipatory energy of maybe I'm next, and it makes everyone sit up and pay attention.
Yeah, it's surprisingly intimate, and to be able to do that.
Good. Kelly, good for you for doing that, by the way, for adopting that approach. Because again, back to this, like, the ridiculous eye contact guidance people get or the pablum that they get, very few actually receive that, which is look at one set of eyes and try to get a reaction from them. When you do, guess what? Then you can look at somebody else. Doesn't need to be 8 to 12 seconds, because you might do that quicker than 8 to 12 seconds, or you might need more than 8 to 12 seconds. So good for you for doing that.
Well, it's funny. Last week I had two speaking dates, and one was a bunch of McDonald's franchisee folks up in Milwaukee, and they were lovely. And the other, you'll dig this, was all the marketing folks for the Broadway road tours. And they were here in Chicago, and I never get to talk to theater kids. So I'm just like, theater kids, like, you're not going to be cynical at the beginning of this. This is awesome. I'm talking about a specific concept. And as I'm doing it to explain it, I look this person in the eye and they look me, and it always works. And it's a good way of doing it. And I just saw someone post on LinkedIn saying, you know, 100 of us were sitting in a room and it really felt like we were sitting around a coffee table together. And mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that's great. I mean, prior to reading your book, I don't think I knew that was what I was doing, or it wasn't even necessarily my intention. But when you are, here's the thing I know from my world, when you are fiercely present in the moment with anyone, they know it. And it doesn't mean I have to be incredibly articulate. It's like I'm using my knowledge and my competence and whatever confidence I've got, but I'm present. And I think it's so rare. It's so rare that someone is completely present in a moment with us that we feel it in one-on-one, and then we really feel it in 100-to-1.
Yeah. You just said it's not, I'm going to share my knowledge and that sort of thing, but it's not about my knowledge. You're right. Because the thing it's really about is your willingness to be focused on them.
Mm-hmm.
Communication attributes that we all think of as the behaviors of confidence, eye contact, enunciation, vocal variety, gestures, posture, all these things, they're not external. They're not shellacked onto the outside of us. They are inputs that come from us trying to reach the other person. So when the person is present in the moment on stage, that's because they're actually trying to reach that, you know, whoever it is, that 1 out of 4,000, which, to your point, what it does is it achieves the rarest of things in this day and age, is it creates a true sense of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And what's shocking, of course, is if the performer does this well, you can have a feeling of, which you just experienced this week, you can have a feeling of intimacy with a massive audience. I mean, of course, you know, it's why people would leave a Frank Sinatra concert and say, seemed like he was just singing to me, or whatever the example is. But you can have a room of 10,000 bodies that feels intimate because of exactly what you're talking about.
You mentioned vocal variety. I'd love to dig into that because that is one of the, that's the five P's. And I think it's hugely important in terms of effective communication. I don't know if you've ever seen the poet David White speak.
No.
Highly recommend it. We bookend a conference for Coca-Cola. He opened, my wife and I closed. He doesn't move. He stands at a microphone. He does not move. And his voice is so like from God. And it's all vocal variety. And like, I have to move. That's, and I think it's important too. But for him, it isn't. So let's, and he embodies these five P's. So can you take us through them?
Yeah, happy to. The first thing I should say is that I did not invent vocal variety. So I hope you read this chapter. I hope you get a ton out of it. I hope you listen to it. But this is not something I invented. I will help you understand it and use a framework to help you get it. But trust me, you know this and you know it in your bones. And humans have been using vocal variety for as long as we've been human. Vocal variety basically means the music in your voice. And I have given it a framework that uses five P's. I have invented this framework, and hopefully it helps it stick in your brain. Five P's that are alliterative that take you through these different dynamics. And they are pace, pitch, pause, power, and placement. I'll say those again. So pace, speed, that's fast and slow. Pitch, which is the musical note on the clef, high or low. Pause, which is just silence.
Mm-hmm.
Power, which is loud or quiet. And then placement is something that you know very well, Kelly, but not everybody does who's listening or viewing, which is where the sound is placed within your body. So if you have a friend with a really nasal voice, what's happening technically, of course, is that the sound is primarily amplifying and resonating in the mask of the face. We're musical instruments, and the sound can amplify and can resonate differently in different parts of our body. So these are the five P's: pace, pitch, pause, power, and placement. Now, we use these for really important reasons. This is not just about being dramatic or sounding good. We use them to convey meaning.
Mm-hmm.
If you say to somebody, pass me the red pen, well, we know that there's blue pens or black pens or other stuff there too. We also use it to convey emotion, which the example I use in the book, if you've ever misread the intent of a text message from a friend and you think they're furious with you and actually they're totally sunny and they just want to invite you out for the day or something or talk, but you've misread their intention, that's because you heard their voice with that text message with faulty vocal variety. You heard like, call me back. And it was meant, call me back. So that's the emotion. We also use it to orient our audience. Do you want this thing or this thing? You can hear this positivity behind. Okay, got it. I should probably choose the second thing. And then the fourth one is that we use it to surprise each other. And we need novelty in life. We need novelty in sound. It's why when you hear a fan long enough, it just disappears, becomes white noise because it's a pattern. And you can tune that out because your brain recognizes, oh, that's a pattern. I don't have to pay attention to it because I've heard it. I know it's there. I can ignore it and now move on to all the other dangers or delights that are around me that I can't predict. So these things, these purposes that vocal variety unlocks, they're profound and profoundly important. And that's why we use these five P's.
That's great. I want to talk about nerves.
Yeah.
So, here's the thing I can tell our audience, which is I've worked with some of the funniest people in the world, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Seth Meyers. All of them get nervous before performing, and none of them were able to eradicate nerves. They have other things that they do, but the thing they never did was beat it.
Yeah.
You can't. Right?
I could not agree more.
So what do you do? So you're sort of like you Heisman armed nurse is kind of how I see it. But you do have these ideas of distance and distraction, which I think are really interesting because, I mean, my friend Nir Eyal said it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. So I do want to go on the record to say a lot of these things can be used to con people out of money.
Yeah,
Sorry.
no, I'm going even further. Not just con people out of money, but if you take the final words I say in the book to heart, what it also means is if you master these things, you could deploy them like a narcissist or like a psychopath, only nefarious reasons, just make you talk really good no matter what your message is. You're right. Good
You would have
move.
sold a lot more books if you had seen the other framing.
Yeah, you know, the nerves thing, they could not. They could not beat it, is the word you used.
No.
And beat is the absolutely the operative word there. That is the verb. You should give that up. I don't just mean you, I mean the royal you. All those negative verbs, beat, suppress, conquer, battle, stop it. It's not going to work. It's going to make it worse because all you're doing is putting yourself in opposition with something, fixating on it more, and then giving into the fallacy that if I don't stop those nerves, I will not be able to do what I want. I will not be able to accomplish my communication mission. And it's simply not true. So the goal should actually be to be able to do something while to communicate effectively while I'm nervous, while I'm anxious. And then actually, by the way, folks, long enough in your career, while I'm bored, while I'm tired, while I'm sick of saying the same things, it's still the same task. Your emotional reality is not the most interesting thing in the moment. What is most interesting is the audience you're trying to reach. So the way to navigate nerves, which is the title of the chapter, navigate, not suppress or destroy or beat, the way to navigate nerves, to your point about distance and distraction, is to find a productive focus where you can put your attention, which essentially is like a positive distraction, as opposed to this death spiral that people typically get into with their nerves.
So where along your journey did you pick up on that? Because that was probably the most salient thing for me, even having studied theater. I wasn't an actor, so I was not as sort of practice enabled. And then when I started doing all the public speaking, I did so much short form, for interviews for TV, and that was always easy. Radio always easy for me. But then suddenly I was doing keynotes, and I'm like, oh, I got to fill like 45 minutes, and that really sort of threw me. And so I had to then sort of develop I knew if I was overscripted, I would have a problem, and I learned this over time and pretty quickly. And the navigation of nerves was probably the hardest for me, and probably took up 3 4 years of being like, I don't, it's like that's not, I of course I have butterflies before I go up, but isn't that never a thing that actually ends up throwing me, in part because I somehow stumbled upon, I think, the tools that you talk about here. Did you stumble upon them? How did you get to this?
First of all, can I give you a huge compliment for having a growth mindset? I mean
Definitely.
that very earnestly. I know that growth mindset sounds like a buzzword in a way. I mean it totally earnestly. Because if you listen to what you said a 3 to 4 year timeline. You said 3 to 4 years. And a lot of us, we give up. We think like, I tried that for 3 days. I guess that's not for me. Some of these skills, folks, God willing, we're better 10 years later than we are today. God willing, we're better 4 years from now than we are right now, because a lot of skills, they're hard won and it's hard to earn them, but they're worth. That's where the battle and the fight should come in. Not fighting the nerves, but battling to learn the skills, working, fighting to learn these skills. So good for you. Good for you. But yes, I did have some aha moments. I did. And I'll share a couple because they can be relevant to people trying to navigate the same thing. So I had just absurd challenges with self-focus as an actor. I would become so self-conscious on stage that it would literally feel like agony to be on stage. I'm not unique, by the way. Any performing artist out there is like, yeah, okay, tell me something I don't know. And of course, you know, Chekhov and the Seagull writes about this sort of thing and characters who feel this acute agony of being on stage. But what is more interesting than me and my agony in those moments was the journey to escape that. And some of that I will absolutely give credit where credit is due to a phenomenal acting teacher named Ron Van Loo, who I studied with at the NYU graduate acting program when I was training to become a professional actor. And the big tool that is incredibly liberating that he was really offering in this particular class and in this particular discussion was that the way to navigate these nerves is not to put yourself in opposition with them, but to, as I said earlier, focus on the other person in the scene. Now, in the book, I try to take that kernel and go a lot farther and give people like incredibly concrete things to do. Stand on the book itself, holding the pages down underneath your feet. Enunciate so dynamically that you can actually feel the gap in space between your upper teeth and your lower teeth. To your point about eye contact, find someone in the audience, look at them until their face changes in some way, or better yet, practice with a small group, throwing a ball to them at the end of each idea to force yourself to look and see, are they ready to catch the ball or not? So using these very concrete things to put your focus elsewhere than you and your nerves. Now, that was a tremendous aha moment for me as a performer. And so I really did get to go on that journey of learning how to not be in constant battle and constant dialogue with my nerves at all times. But then what happened to me is that I got even more interested than doing it myself. I got even more interested in watching how people learn and watching how they learn to play a different character. But now, more appropriate to my life, how they learn to play the character of themselves in their life and communicate effectively in situations that matter.
And I think the other thing that we know this from social science, right? We're many characters.
Yeah.
So the character you are in one moment is going to be different. And that's not flip-flopping.
Oh.
That's there's so many scripts. There's so many plays.
But thank you for saying this, okay? Because I feel as though there has been we've been inundated in the last two decades with authenticity.
Yeah.
And know yourself and bring your whole self to work. And I'm making fun of that gently, okay? I promise if I'm now like, you know, getting to any sacred cows, I apologize, folks. I'll tell you why I'm saying this, all right? I am a fan of bringing your whole self to work. Good for you.
Sure.
Yes. And I'm also a fan of feeling a deep sense of authenticity. Great. But what I am not a fan of is people framing that in such a limited way that they actually close down their life. So I'll give you an example from my coaching work. I will work with people very often just on posture, a simple exercise of posture. And the first obstacle they will always throw my way is like, yeah, okay, yeah, but that's just not natural. Inevitably, now if people are just listening, you can't see this, but I'll do it now so you can see, Kelly. Uh-huh. Inevitably, they're saying that to me in some position like this, you know?
A fetal position of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. That doesn't feel natural. And it's not natural at all. It's what has become habitual for them. So when you talk about, and we change, we're different people. We're different people in different situations, different contexts. Yes, you are larger than just your presentation self or just your professional self. And the idea that, wow, I can derive a tremendous sense of comfort and even self-identity by relieving myself of some of the artificial ideas of like what is authentic and what is natural, and instead being more interested and more fascinated by the person I'm trying to reach. And that other focus actually liberates a much bigger idea of who you are. It can actually be massively freeing. I'll give you an example. So I taught at Columbia Business School for 5 years. And one of the exercises in this course I taught called The Leader's Voice was to write a 6-word story for your life. Now, you've probably heard of the 6-word story.
Sure.
Hemingway, supposedly, it's apocryphal, by the way, so we don't even know if it actually happened. But supposedly, Hemingway won a bet with a drinking buddy about who could write the best short story, and Hemingway writes a 6-word story. Whether or not it's true, I don't know. But the 6-word story is a fun exercise, and I would have my students at Columbia write the 6-word story for their life. Now, I'm giving that whole preamble a background because the 6-word story that I wrote from my life was focusing on others, I found myself. So this idea of authenticity, what was tremendously freeing for me as a professional and as an adult was that, wow, I don't have to cling to like, well, what is, who am I exactly? Who am I? What is my authentic experience? But instead, wow, let go of a lot of that and just focus on other people. And it began to all of a sudden inform much more powerfully who I actually think I am.
Yeah, the exercise that I noted this in the margins when I was reading the book, is the exercise we use is called 60-30-10. Tell me who you are in 60 seconds, then 30 seconds, then 10 seconds. And then often now we say, and what's your hashtag?
Yeah.
So that level of being able, you're accomplishing a number of things. One is also, sometimes you have 60 seconds. Mm-hmm. And what does it feel to fill up that period of time? I always think that's an interesting thing because we misjudge time completely. And I noticed in a couple of ways recently. One is I went back to my old dentist. I had this great dentist. I left him for a while. I went back to him and he's like, Kelly, what's your deal in terms of the morning? And he's like, do you have your iPad with you? And is there a clock in there? He goes, I want you to brush for 2 minutes. Just like set your timer. 2 minutes is forever. Like it's just embarrassing that I wasn't doing that. And then I've been listening to this podcast and we're going to have the guys on, I think, in a couple of months. And it's called Love Factually. And it's two social scientists, they're relationship scientists, who break down rom-coms. So they'll watch a rom-com and then they'll talk about the relationship science underneath it. And one of the gimmicks they use at the beginning is you have 1 minute to tell me what the plot of the movie is. And it's a great way to open episodes because it forces you into this constrained bit of time and it gamifies the moment. And it really, I'm like, wow, they have found a number of little ways to enter into these conversations and start these conversations in entirely effective modes that are just time-based.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. This is a slight tangent, but it's not actually. So we built an app, a practice app. It's called Question Roulette. It's free, Apple, Android. So folks out there, if you want to get a cool tool to practice, that's the name of it. Question Roulette. Like you're asking a question and playing the casino game roulette. Question Roulette. I'm saying that whole thing because in there, we give people rate of speech. Now, if you Google rate of speech, almost everywhere you'll see it, they give it to you as words per minute. And so then the average is like, you know, between 120 and 240 words per minute. It's a huge range, right? But it tends to narrow down to like 150 to 180 words per minute. Where I'm going with this is ask anyone how long a minute is when they're speaking. They have no idea. And then ask them this, how many words did you say in that minute? And they're 4,000, 10. I have no idea. So within the app, it was very important to me that we measure for people the rate of speech to seconds because their perception is still off about a second, by the way, but it's closer and they can have a better sense of how long a second is and at least an idea of how many words they might be saying per second. So your point about 60 seconds versus 10 seconds, yes. Yes, and to that point.
Yeah, and I think that it's a fact that's maybe good to have some knowledge of and then forget it.
Yeah.
But it gives you at least a better understanding. Well, you know, from just writing the book, right? Because there's like you sign a contract for a certain amount of words. And up until I wrote my book, I was never like, what's a 900 word thing? What's a 1500? Because I didn't write a bunch of columns for, you know, I put stuff on LinkedIn. It could be ever hour long. But then when you're having like, you're getting paid by it, you have to look at it. And it very much changes your relationship to words on a page.
For sure. Yeah. Well, and then here's the funny part, everybody. Then all of a sudden at the beginning, you're thinking, how am I ever going to get 60,000 words? And then towards the end, you're like, how am I going to cut it down to 60,000 words? So the original one, I think the original proposal to the publisher said like 120,000 words. Publisher said like, whoa, 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 back off.
No way.
The whole book is about 70,000 words, which if you'd said that to me ahead of time, I'd think that sounds like from here to eternity.
Right.
You know, and it's actually for these kinds of books, it's pretty middle of the road, actually.
That's average. Yeah. All right. We always on the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do, but is it cheating to tell a story that's not about me, but about my wife?
No, I love that.
Okay. It's not my story to tell, it is hers, but the reason I'm telling it is because it has such a massive, massive impact on my life.
Right.
Folks, I met my wife on the subway platform in New York City. And I walked out on the subway platform, and she's on the platform, and I feel like I want to go talk to this person. So I strike up a conversation, and we go exactly two stops from 72nd Street to 66th and then to 59th, and she's getting off on 59th Street. And between 66th and 59th, I ask her out. I ask her for her phone number. And as she tells the story, she had been in relationships, by the way, for more than two decades. This was a brief moment in her life in which actually, because of the end of one relationship that did not go well, there was this brief moment in two decades in which she could actually say yes and. And so literally what came out of her mouth was, yes, and this is my stop, so you better get my number quick. And as she was having this thought, she's told me this, that she was ready to say, no, that's okay, no thanks, I'm flattered, but no. She was literally halfway down that decision tree, and it dawned on her, I mean, the random guy in the subway, right? Why is she saying yes to subway guy? It dawns on her, she can say yes. And so she did. She said, yes, and this is my stop, so you better get the number quick. So that's the yes and story. And now we have two kids. We've been together for more than a decade. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. So you get the idea. It had a big impact on my life.
That's a great story. The book is called Don't Say How to Communicate Effectively to Live a Better Life. Michael Chad Hefner, thank you for coming on the pod.
It's my pleasure, Kelly. Thank you.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.